It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Historically, labor unions have been a major force in U.S. politics, but have political losses in recent years changed their role? We discuss how legislation in Wisconsin has impacted the power of labor unions and how union affiliation does or doesn't matter in the 2018 midterms. Are you a member of a labor union? Does it impact the way you vote? What do you think about candidates who get the support of pro-union groups? And what about anti-union candidates? 800-642-1234. Dan Bice is a watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering Wisconsin government and politics. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me, John.
So historically, let's talk about the role of labor unions in politics.
They've been pretty powerful here in Wisconsin and nationally. There is a reason that Scott Walker went after labor unions with Act 10 in 2011. You know, the state, Wisconsin, was the first state to allow its public sector employees to bargain collectively. And as a result of that and other things, the unions became very powerful and became a major part of the democratic infrastructure, providing money and, more importantly, people to get out to vote to help Democratic candidates.
So you mentioned Act 10. Also, there's this thing called the Right to Work Law. How did those things impact union power in Wisconsin?
It devastated them. I was talking just this morning with someone close to the governor, and they said that they broke the back of organized labor in Wisconsin. The number of members of unions in the state dropped precipitously. Some unions lost more than 50% of their members. WEAC, the teachers union, suffered major losses, ended up laying off more than 40% of their staff. I think overall the numbers dropped from about 355,000 members of unions in Wisconsin down to a little more than 200,000 a couple years ago. And there's been a little bit of a resurgence up to about 230,000, but still they're not in the position that they used to be.
Randy Bryce is an iron worker who's running for Paul Ryan's seat in the Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. How has union support driven his campaign?
Well, he's a union member. He was very active with Act 10 and, in fact, got arrested for his activities with legislation and stuff and protests. He's in a tough district because Donald Trump won the 1st Congressional District by a good 10, 11 points just 2 years ago. And Paul Ryan, who's decided not to run again and for whose seat he's running, has not dismantled his campaign infrastructure. His campaign is still very active there. Unions are helping him a good deal. But what we haven't seen yet is a big insurgence from outside national labor unions. Of all the money that Randy's raised so far, I think it's a little over $6 million, about $250,000 comes from unions and union groups. So it's there, it's significant, but, there's a reason that he's appears to be trailing in the polls right now.
Well, it is a tough district. Is Randy Bryce an outlier, or are there other union-endorsed candidates elsewhere in Wisconsin?
Well, the unions, that district is more red than the rest of Wisconsin. People like to say the state is purple, and I tend to think that it's extremely red in some places, extremely blue in some places. But the race to watch is the governor's race, Scott Walker against Tony Evers, and the local labor unions, interestingly, did not back up and support Tony Evers in the primary. They instead supported another candidate, Malin Mitchell, who finished second in the race. But Tony won by a sizable margin, and it wasn't long after the primary victory that he received. So far, he's received $700,000-$800,000 from labor unions, and there have been a few national unions that have moved in and started, particularly in trying to get out the vote efforts. And the main union so far that I'm told is the SEIU, the Service Employees International, is very active in Milwaukee right now, trying to do what it can to make sure its members get out and the other people not affiliated with the unions get out.
Dan Bice is a watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering Wisconsin government and politics. We're talking about the impact of unions in the midterm election and whether or not they still have any power. Speaking of unions, how has the AFL-CIO, which is one of Wisconsin's largest unions, made an impact on state politics in Wisconsin during these midterms?
They have had an impact so far. It's an interesting situation for Wisconsin because they just recently had a convention here in Milwaukee, and they've made a major switch in who runs the union. Phil Neuenfeld had run the union for the last 8 years, and he's being replaced by a new leader of the organization, and they've had problems just like everybody else in the state in terms of losing membership, and in terms of the national influence in the unions as Wisconsin. You know, in 2012, when there was the recall race, a lot of national unions came here and thought that they could beat Scott Walker, and they didn't. And then in 2016. The union state didn't come into the state, and Donald Trump ends up taking the state, which was a big surprise to everybody. So I think we're looking this time at sort of a middle path where the unions aren't going to be extremely influential this time, but they are going to be here in some numbers, greater than they were in 2016.
Let's try and work a quick call in here. We'll go to John in Marquette. And, John, we're almost out of time in this segment, so I'll ask you to be as brief as you can.
Okay, real quick, yeah, what I see as a major problem, I've been a union member for 25 years, is that the Democratic Party, as it moves further to the left, is pulling further away from the members that actually, I'm talking about the mining people, steel workers, and I think what happened was Trump came in and he talked more to the needs and desires and the future as far as industrial future, then the Democrats have been talking to us, and I've always voted Democrat, but I just can't continue to support the party that's typically anti-mining and anti-logging and everything
okay.
else.
I'm all right. Curious. So, Dan, the unions and the Democratic Party have often been aligned. Is that starting to change?
Actually, there's been a tension for a while. You know, in the recall elections, the unions did not pick the candidate who won. They backed Kathleen Falk. She loses in the primary, and Tom Barrett wins. This time, the unions picked Malin Mitchell, and he doesn't win. Tony Evers wins. So there is a tension between the two, the unions frequently pushing the party to the left. And, you know, that is an internal struggle. How much does the Democratic Party allow the unions to dictate or control the direction that they take?
Does union support usually favor one party or another over another, or does it depend on the specific union?
Most union support supports the Democrats, but there are two unions in the state that have backed Scott Walker from the beginning, and that's the Milwaukee Police Association and the Milwaukee Firefighters Association. And what's interesting this time is the Milwaukee Firefighters have not endorsed anybody, and I've yet to see whether the Milwaukee Police has endorsed anybody. I just wrote to the head of the organization last week and asked whether they had announced their endorsement and got no response.
All right.
That would be very interesting if they don't, because Act 10 specifically excluded police and firefighters from the measures in that legislation.
All right, Dan, thanks. Thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Sure, thanks.
Dan Bice is a watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering Wisconsin government and politics. Coming up next, in an era of Me Too and sexual assault allegations, what should good sex education entail? Our guest has advice for parents and educators looking to navigate the waters of 21st century sex ed. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In the era of Me Too and sexual assault allegations, what should good sex education entail? We'll get some advice for parents and educators looking to navigate the waters of 21st century sex ed and find out why conversations about consent, boundaries, and body positivity are crucial. How do you talk to your kids about sex in the era of Me Too? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Bonnie J. Roth, author of Beyond Birds and Bees, Bringing Home a New Message to Our Kids About Sex, Love, and Equality. She also penned the recent New York Times piece, The New Birds and Bees, Teaching Kids About Boundaries and Consent. Bonnie, welcome to The Morning Show.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's a lot going on in the news today between coverage of sexual assault allegations involving Brett Kavanaugh, the Why I Didn't Report movement, and more. What do you think parents are thinking about when it comes to what they need to talk to their children about?
You know, that's a great question. I think for a long time, American parents have been aware of the fact that we need to equip our kids from an early age with honest, open, age-appropriate information about their bodies and other people's so that we can all stay healthy and safe and happy in our skins. But there's something that I think is becoming clearer now to American families and educators, and that's that sex education has world-class sex education, the very best, has a whole other side, which is social and emotional. So teaching kids about sex has so much more to do to do with relationships and emotions and decision making, those kinds of social skills, than just biology and medical terminology and the body. So we're working now on trying to figure out how to bring all that together. And luckily, there are some really good models out there for us to understand how to equip kids with those great the great things they need to know about learning their own boundaries and learning to respect those of other people.
What are some of those good examples of how it should be done?
Well, for me personally, I had my opportunity to learn as a mom when I moved to the Netherlands with my family when my first child was still just pretty much just a toddler. She was just about 2 years old. We moved to the Netherlands, and right away, as a new parent, as I'm looking around kind of trying to pick up clues about this whole thing about how do we raise kids, I started to see Dutch parents and teachers dealing really differently than I'd ever seen before in the United States with the teaching of basically what I realized later was human sexuality. That meant being really open with kids about terminology, very open as well about nudity. They had a really clear sense of the difference between nudity that was non-sexual every day, you know, swimming in the wading pool or changing at home with, you know, in the morning with your family, compared to erotic nudity, which is, you know, not something for children. So I was starting to see these examples, and then eventually learned that there was a lot more going on that my kid wasn't old enough for yet. Sex ed starting in kindergarten, and it wasn't just the old-fashioned kind of birds and bees talk. Sex ed in the Netherlands is also like the very best sex ed here in the United States. It's based on a model called comprehensive sexuality education, and it's K through 12. So time is spent every year in the classroom teaching children not only about bodies and human reproduction, but also importantly about knowing oneself, keeping your self-esteem strong, and also understanding relationship skills, how to make decisions with other people, how to have a more egalitarian mindset to break down. They're working with kindergartners and first graders on identifying and resisting gender stereotypes and inclusivity. So I was seeing all that happening and also realizing that I felt fantastic as an adult woman in my body, more so than I ever had before. And eventually I was able to learn that that had to do with this brief, wonderful opportunity I had to live in one of the world's most gender-equal countries. So when I started to put the pieces together, I saw that what the Dutch were doing, those little everyday ways that they were teaching children to be comfortable and not embarrassed about their bodies and kind of rooting out shame from an early age, was giving them the confidence to have healthy sexuality, some of the world's best sexual health outcomes in the world, along with some of the highest gender equality in the world.
And sometimes we rely on schools and teachers to handle this topic for us. I mean, is that a mistake? Does this need to start with parents?
This is a great question, and I think that almost anywhere you ask in the world, everyone agrees that parents should and very often want to be the number one go-to resource for their kids about human sexuality. However, not all parents are up to the task. Not all of us even really feel like, you know, those of us who want to do a really great job aren't really sure how. We, you know, we're wondering, are we missing something? Is there something new that I need to be teaching my kids that maybe I didn't learn from my parents? And so, yes, parents, I think, feel rightly most responsible for making sure their children are educated. However, even the World Health Organization says that sexual knowledge of one's own body is actually a human right. So in some countries, that's taken a lot more seriously. So there's a really really reliable safety net, really, in the schools, kind of a backup system. And what's really important about school sex ed that I learned, because I looked and looked at all different ways that young people can learn about sexuality, what's really important about sex ed in schools or churches or community centers, the formal sex ed that's offered to children together with their peer group, is that what happens is the community all gets the same information at the same time. So they can all trust in what they can expect rightfully from one another and build those social norms together. And, you know, I'm someone who cares a lot about this stuff, having come a long way, not knowing much about it at all when I was first becoming a parent. But I still feel like, you know, there's only so much I can do. I can't reach my children's peer collective as much as I would love to. That comes from us as adults in the culture. We need to make it more of a norm in homes and in schools.
Bonnie J. Ruff is the author of Beyond Birds and Bees, bringing home a new message to our kids about sex, love, and equality. We're talking about how to change the conversation when it comes to learning about our bodies and about sexuality in America. And let's talk more about body positivity. What does that mean in this context?
Yeah, body positivity. I think that it really, unfortunately, can happen from a very early age, that without meaning to, it's just an inadvertent thing, we can tend to send the messages, even to babies, that certain body parts are maybe less acceptable or less ordinary, less even less safe than other body parts, which, you know, that's a moral judgment. That's not something that kids are born sensing. But when we see kids with body shame, kids who are who can name their nose or their elbow, but can't quite, but maybe don't even know appropriate words for their genitals. They're getting the message that there's something about these other body parts to be embarrassed about, to feel shame about, to be afraid of, and it could actually be dangerous. And so what happens is they become less and less spoken of, and unfortunately that's the kind of that mechanism that builds shame, and that shame, unfortunately, creates the silence that can be something that, let's say, perpetrators rely on to keep their victims silent. So,
well, and that's kind of the big challenge when we let fear motivate our talk of sex education, isn't it? And how does that play out?
That's exactly right. So that was something that really struck me when I was learning all of these great statistics about sexual health in the Netherlands and comparing them to ours. So Dutch and American teenagers do tend to have sex for the first time at about the same age, which is about between 17 and 18. But American teenagers actually have babies, unfortunately, at more than 5 times the rate of their Dutch peers. And those Dutch young people also catch fewer STIs and, in general, take fewer sexual risks. But I also learned that the Dutch teenagers are even more than twice as likely as their American peers to characterize their first time having sex as a positive experience that was fully wanted, in their control, well-timed, enjoyed. And that's when, as a parent, I went, okay, I've been thinking about teaching my kids about the birds and the bees from a perspective of what I'm afraid of, what I don't want to have happen, but I want to change my mindset. This is about thinking in terms of hopes and dreams for my kids, like I do in every other area of their lives and their nurturing and development. So in my book, Beyond Birds and Bees, it's very much about what was it like for me to change that mindset, and what did I learn when I went out and looked at parents and educators who have already made that shift and how they're teaching body positivity and sex positivity in a way that helps every child to feel high self-esteem and confidence in their skin so that they know that they have the right to say no, to say yes, to say, you know, this isn't for me. Whatever it is, they know that they can own those decisions because their body is theirs.
Bonnie J. Rumpf stays with us, and she's the author of Beyond Birds and Bees, bringing home a new message to our kids about sex, love, and equality. Still to come, we have a conversation about consent and how we teach that. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. How do you talk to your kids about sex in the era of Me Too and Why I Didn't Report? That's what we're talking about this morning with Bonnie J. Rumpf, author of Beyond the Birds and Bees, bringing home a new message to our kids about sex, love, and equality. She also penned the recent New York Times piece, The New Birds and Bees, teaching kids about boundaries and consent. What do kids need to know most these days when it comes to consent and boundaries, and how do you teach those concepts? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bonnie, let's talk about consent. Very few states require the teaching of consent as part of their sex ed curriculum. That was something that kind of surprised me. So how can parents discuss that with children of all ages?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with teaching kids to recognize what their own boundaries are. So that can happen with something like you can invite a child to roll up their sleeve and try tickling their own arm or scratching their own arm or a little bit of pinching, and ask them to identify what do they like, what do they not like. And then they can find out, you know, maybe from someone else in the room, in the family or a friend, when this happens in part of a comprehensive sexuality education curriculum for kindergartners or first graders, the teacher will have all the children in the room do the same exercise and then to compare. And what children start to discover is that everyone has different boundaries. This person might like a little bit more of a scratching, while someone else just wants a really light tickling on their arm. And so what children can start to understand is that what they like and what they want isn't always what someone else likes and what someone else wants. We teach them that they need to ask first before they lay hands on another person's body, and then they also have the right to expect that other people will do the same for them. And I think that we have some kind of old, traditional norms in American culture that feel a little tough to question. But, for example, you know, that required kiss for auntie or for grandpa, there's a lot of, you know, awareness now that telling a child your body is yours and you get to decide who touches it and get to be the boss of yourself in that way, and then telling them now you have to go give so-and-so a kiss hello or a hug goodbye, that goes right against that that teaching. And so we might notice in a child when they're uncomfortable in that situation and say, oh, I see you, maybe you're not comfortable giving a hug. That's fine. Is there a verbal way you can say goodbye? You want to just wave or something like that? So honoring a child's boundaries when we see opportunities to help them discover what they are. And then just reminding them that, you know, whether they want to chase someone on the playground, whether they want to, play with someone's hair, that asking first is a great habit. And that and then the next level, too, is making sure that children understand that having someone say yes clearly or no clearly isn't always going to be the case, and that we can teach kids to watch for other cues, especially cues that mean no. If someone doesn't look happy, if they look like, they're uncomfortable, or if they're not saying no, but they're shaking their head, these are great lessons we can teach siblings, maybe around tickling, and we can also teach kids by modeling that ourselves as adults. Tickling is one of a lot of sex educators' favorite examples for how to teach consent, because as adults, we're engaging in something that's fun and feels good, but there are all kinds of different varieties on it. And so, you know, kids might want to be tickled on the bottom of the foot, but not in the armpits. And asking and understanding if we're crossing boundaries while tickling, I know it might sound like it takes the fun out of it a little bit, but actually what it's instilling for the child is a sense of their right to have control over their bodies, so that they know that they don't have to be coerced and they don't have to be pestered into doing something that someone else doesn't want to. It's not right to have that, to be pressured.
Well, in so much of this, touching is culturally regulated, isn't it? I mean, and how do you tell a great-grandma that she isn't owed a hug?
Isn't that hard? You know, as adults, sometimes I think what we do with our kids is often a response to what we think the adults around us might say if we do something different. And that's been a journey for me as a parent, is just feeling in the moment, you know, who am I really here to protect? My own, you know, social dynamic with, you know, my great aunt, or my child's, you know, own social development, who, you know, the 5-year-old in the room. And sometimes I think, I've seen myself do this and really have worked hard on just kind of taking a deep breath and focusing on, you know, the vulnerable person in the room is the small learning child, and I'm an adult. I can handle explaining to the great aunt or whoever it is, you know, later in the moment. But sometimes just a real kind of lighthearted, casual, oh, yeah, looks like we're not in the mood for a hug, but, maybe the child doesn't want to touch at all, so high five isn't a good suggestion either. But, we as adults, I think, can finesse the moment a lot better than a child can when we put that pressure on them.
Bonnie J. Ruff is the author of Beyond Birds and Bees, bringing home a new message to our kids about sex, love, and equality. We're talking about teaching children about sexuality in the era of Me Too and Why I Didn't Report. When we're talking about teaching some of these kinds of things to very small children, is this something that they're really going to get later on? Maybe will they understand it right off the bat?
Well, there's building blocks, right? So the first thing we can teach very, very young children, even babies, is this gets back to that body positivity question. So, you know, we learned from our daughter's preschool teachers in the Netherlands. She helped us straighten out our language so that we didn't talk about, when we were working on potty training, we didn't talk about a diaper anymore as stinky or dirty, but just, you know, full or wet or dry. So she taught us to, actually several of the teachers taught us to use more neutral language that didn't seem to have a kind of a value statement laid into it, especially not a negative value statement about body functions. So we can actually use those really early opportunities of diaper changes and toileting just to teach kids that their bodies are great, their bodies are supposed to be here, all the parts, and eventually, once with that pride in themselves, we can teach them by repetition, because repetition is important in everything. I mean, just think how many times you've, you know, probably told kids, you know, to eat their vegetables or get a little more protein. So repetition is important, but what we want to teach about consent is that everybody has a right to their own boundaries. We ask first, and when someone says yes, we want to really see that they mean it.
Do we need to tailor our approach to this based on gender at all?
I think that is an awesome question, because I know some people want to know specifically, you know, how do I talk to boys about consent, or how do I talk to girls about consent? And for me, I often just come back to the sense that we talk to them in the same way, at the same time, together, in the same room, and that goes for all of sexuality education, so that we help them to normalize each other's body experiences and psychological experiences of human sexuality, and to be a little bit more allied with one another, and knowing that everybody grows up in a human body, and our experiences of that might be different, but our experiences of that aren't unusual and don't have to be foreign to one another. So I think actually teaching kids, giving kids the same messages and teaching them the same expectations really sets them up to build more egalitarianism, which in fact is a protective factor against perpetration of sexual violence.
How do we model this to as adults? How do we model things like consent and body positivity to young people?
Yeah, oh my gosh, especially as parents and educators, we have so many opportunities every day. Certainly we can remind kids in their own play, but also in their play with us, right? I mean, probably there are a lot of listeners out there who have had a child either climbing on them or poking them and doing something that maybe we didn't want in the moment. And so knowing that we, too, don't have to allow another person, even a child, to touch us in a way that we're not into at the moment. You know what? Maybe I'm trying to concentrate. Maybe I'm on the telephone and it's driving me crazy to have someone tugging on my earring. So I can make sure that I use my voice and say, no, thank you. I don't want that right now. Or please stop it. No. Mm-hmm. And to let them know, kids, we have to keep reminding them. So we can model it with them. We can also model it with one another as adults. There's so many opportunities in daily life. I think one of the most important things that kids can do is to have healthcare providers who have a strong ideal about teaching consent. So a pediatrician who asks first before doing any kind of a physical examination on a child who says, here's what's next. Is that okay with you? I think that modeling from healthcare professionals is so important. And it even comes right down to dentists and
sure.
Anybody who works on a body can teach a child that they have the right to say yes and no by asking them first before they touch.
We have less than a minute left, but I'd like to have you leave us with a question that parents could ask their child tonight to start a conversation about this topic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I always like to invite stories by sometimes sharing something of my own. So I might think of a time when, you know, I could tell my child, you know, once when I was a little kid and I was playing at a friend's house, we were roughhousing and I was getting pickled and I was saying stop because I didn't want that anymore. But my friend didn't stop. And I was wondering if anything like that ever happened to you, if you would know what to do or what to say. Or maybe just more simply, to ask a child, do you know what you like when you go to bed? Do you like to have your back tickled, or do you like to have your hair stroked? And just invite a child to name their preferences, because this isn't all about saying no. It's also about owning our wonderful bodies and learning to live in and enjoy them.
Bonnie, thanks for spending this time with us. It was very informative.
I really appreciate it.
Bonnie J. Ruff is the author of Beyond Birds and Bees, bringing home a new message to our kids about sex, love, and equality. Coming up, Beyond the Ballot looks at how we cope with the cost of prescription drugs in Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This election season, Wisconsin Public Radio is meeting people where they are in their communities to talk about issues that matter most to them. As part of our ongoing conversations about the Beyond the Ballot project, we look at how Wisconsinites are dealing with prescription drug prices. Joining me, as she always does for these segments, Bridget Bowden, special project reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She's project manager of Beyond the Ballot. Bridget, good morning.
Good morning.
We're about 5 weeks away from the election. What is the Beyond the Ballot team working to achieve by then?
A few things. So our number one goal is to do 500 interviews. So we have quite a few more to go. So we'll be working really hard this month to talk to people all around the state. And we'll also be putting together stories using the interviews that we've already done.
We know that as a part of Beyond the Ballot, prescription drug prices are on people's minds. Let's turn first to Sandra Fick. What is her take on this?
Right. So Sandra is from Toma, and she sees the effects of prescription drug costs on the people she works with every day.
I'm an EMS worker, so I see a lot of people that are making decisions about drugs, whether to buy drugs, prescriptions that they need, or whether to eat, and that's not right.
So for some, prescription drugs play a vital role in continued health. What do high prices mean for Karen Hill?
Right. So this is an issue that comes up a lot. And for some people, it's a life or death issue. So like you said, this is Karen Hill, and she's from Milwaukee.
The cost of medication is so overwhelming. My husband's a diabetic. And so for the cost of insulin, it's crazy. I mean, even with our insurance, and we have our Medicare, but we also bought a supplement. We pay an additional $456 a month for a supplement. And that still doesn't pay for all the medication. Well, you cut back on, other things at home. You know, you cut back on your budget. You cut back on, you don't take a vacation. You don't buy as much food as you would want. You cut back anywhere you can. That's what you have to do in order to afford medication.
The cost of insulin comes up a lot in discussions of what it costs to buy prescription medicine. We've seen some price spikes in that, and it's really become a big issue. Did you hear this from others as well, that this type of thing was getting to be a real problem, where people had to decide between their prescriptions and putting food on the table?
Yeah, so this is a topic that comes up a lot in these interviews, and our questions are pretty vague. So we're asking, what's the most important issue to you? What can you tell me about a time the government has done something that hurt you or helped you? And this is something that people bring up on their own because it's very important to them.
Bridget Bowden is special projects reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She's project manager of Beyond the Ballot. Bridget, you have one more experience to share with us this morning. What is Charles Satterfield's experience with drug prices?
So Charles is from Madison, and when I interviewed him, he had actually been homeless for about 3 months, and he said the cost of his medication is one of his top concerns this election year.
I retired, and I get Social Security, but it's not doing anything because I still got to pay for my medicine. And my medicine is expensive because I have heart problems. And that medicine is expensive. But like, I don't run out of medicine now, and I can't afford to pay for it until I get my check. It's nothing I can do but deal with it and hope I don't die in the process.
Prescription drug price is just one health issue coming up as part of Beyond the Ballot. What else are people watching?
So healthcare comes up a lot, and prescription drugs are just one piece of that. People are concerned about the cost of their healthcare in general, and things like pre-existing conditions and the Affordable Care Act. These are all topics that come up a lot in these interviews. And again, all of our questions are very open-ended. So these are things that people are bringing up on their own because they care.
And how can people get involved if they want to share their own concerns or successes when it comes to getting the drugs they need?
Yeah, so like I said, we have a lot of interviews to do, so we would absolutely love it if people would reach out to us. So we have a couple of different ways that you can do that, but probably the best way is to go to our website. It's WPR.org/ballot, and there's a survey you can fill out right there, answer all of our questions, and maybe we'll reach out to you for an interview.
WPR.org/ballot. Okay, we got it. Bridget, thanks so much for joining us again this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Bridget Bowden is special projects reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She's project manager of Beyond the Ballot, and she joins us regularly for these features on The Morning Show. Governor Scott Walker's decision to pledge billions of dollars to lure tech giant Foxconn to Wisconsin is shaping the debate on economic development in this year's race for governor. As Laurel White reports, Walker won't rule out more Foxconn-style deals in the future, while Democrat Tony Evers says the governor is taking the state down a slippery slope.
Over the course of the past couple years, Governor Scott Walker said repeatedly that something like the state's deal with Foxconn doesn't come around very often.
This once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Wisconsin and this new Foxconn...
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Wisconsin
But Foxconn's status as a once-in-a-lifetime deal didn't last very long. It was only about 6 months later when the governor decided to pull out the Foxconn playbook in an attempt to keep consumer products company Kimberly-Clark from closing two plants in Wisconsin.
This is a large industry that has a multiple ripple effect out there. And I think in this case, we're looking when something has such a large impact, we're willing to put a significant offer on the table.
Since that proposal, the governor has insisted that Foxconn-style deals aren't going to be his go-to economic strategy in the future, despite what it may look like. Kimberly-Clark, he says, is special, like Foxconn.
The reason why we looked at Kimberly-Clark in a similar way to we did at Foxconn is these are transformational, industry-driven careers.
Timothy Bartik is a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says the governor might have trouble being as selective as he wants to be with incentive deals now that he's set a precedent. Bartik says incentives are like potato chips.
When it comes to incentives, you can't hand out just one.
Bartik has studied economic incentive packages all over the country. He says Foxconn got 10 times the incentives businesses usually get.
You know, essentially with Foxconn, they kind of threw out all the old rules.
Bartik says Wisconsin doesn't have enough money to keep handing out deals like Foxconn's. He says the state needs to be very picky about who qualifies for incentives. Governor Walker says he's doing that. He points out that Bonton, which had corporate offices in Milwaukee, announced plans to close stores and cut thousands of jobs. In that situation, state government did not step in. But the governor's Democratic opponent, State School Superintendent Tony Evers, argues Walker's deal with Foxconn was motivated by politics, not economic development. Evers says he has a different vision for how to spur Wisconsin's economy.
We are going to move away from the idea that somehow we need to throw a Hail Mary pass every 4 years in order to make economy grow in the state of Wisconsin.
Evers wants to eliminate the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which approved the state's contract with Foxconn. He also says he wants to do more to keep state money in local communities by setting up loan programs for small businesses and startups.
Economic development in the state of Wisconsin should be a 72-county solution, not a southeast Wisconsin versus the rest of the state.
Evers won't commit one way or another to the Kimberly-Clark deal. He says he needs more details. But he says offers like it set a bad precedent.
Well, it certainly gives us pause, right? That if it's Kimberly-Clark, then it's somebody else and somebody else.
Evers says incentive deals like Foxconn and Kimberly-Clark can give the government too much power to pick winners and losers in business. Walker says they're evidence that he'll do whatever it takes when it comes to jobs. Whether future companies get the same treatment could hinge on who's governor for the next 4 years, leaving voters to choose who they think will give them the biggest bang for their buck. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For more coverage on Foxconn, visit WPR.org. Coming up on the morning show, Wisconsin could be the one of the best places in the country for lab monkeys to go to retire. We'll find out more about that when the morning show continues in just a moment. Lots more to come, so please stay with us. I'm John Munson. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around.